You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Aloud. My name is Miranda King, and I'm the program producer here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Through fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programs, the Library Foundation strengthens and promotes greater awareness of the Los Angeles Public Library and its valuable services. The Los Angeles Public Library supports Angelenos with access to information, educational assistance, literacy instruction, social programs, and the assurance everyone is welcome at their 73 locations. In the last 50 years, America has changed a great deal, and the short story has with it. We are pleased to welcome editor John Freeman and three other driving forces behind this evolution: Sandra Cisneros, George Saunders, and Manuel Munoz, all contributors to the newly released Penguin Book of the Modern American Short Story. Sandra Cisneros is a poet, short story writer, novelist, and essayist whose work explores the lives of the working class. She is the winner of many awards, including NEA fellowships in both poetry and fiction, a MacArthur Fellowship, and the National Medal of the Arts, awarded to her by President Obama in 2016. Her novel, The House on Mango Street, has sold over 6 million copies, has been translated into over 20 languages, and is required reading in elementary, high school, and universities across the nation. A new book, Martita, I Remember You, Martita, Te Recuerdo, a story in English and in Spanish, will be published this fall. Manuel Munoz is the author of two collections of short stories, Zigzagger and The Faith Healer of Olive Avenue, which was shortlisted for the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. His first novel, What You See in the Dark, was published in 2011. Three of his short stories have received the O. Henry Prize, and one was chosen for inclusion in Best American Short Stories. The Consequences, Munoz's third collection, will be published by Grey Wolf Press. George Saunders is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 10 books, including Lincoln and the Bardo, which won the Man Booker Prize, 10th of December, a finalist for the National Book Award, and the critically acclaimed short story collections, Civil War Land in Bad Decline and Pastoralia. His newest book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, released in January, is an analysis of seven classic Russian short stories and is dedicated to the students he teaches in the creative writing program at Syracuse University. He is a recipient of the Los Angeles Public Library's Literary Award and is a great friend of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Our host, John Freeman, is the editor of Freeman's, a literary annual of new writing, and an executive editor at Alfred A. Knopf. His books include How to Read a Novelist, Tales of Two Americas, and Tales of Two Planets. His work is translated into more than 20 languages and has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and The New York Times. The former editor of Granta, he teaches writing at New York University. Our program will begin tonight with a reading by George Saunders, followed by a reading from Manuel Munoz. Please welcome George Saunders.
It's telling me that the host has to start my video, Miranda. There we go, okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you for supporting the magnificent Los Angeles Library. Nice to be here. I'm gonna read just a short story called Sticks, a very short story. Every year, Thanksgiving night, we flocked out behind Dad as he dragged the Santa suit to the road and draped it over a kind of crucifix he'd built out of metal pole in the yard. Super Bowl week, the pole was dressed in a jersey and Rod's helmet, and Rod had to clear it with Dad if he wanted to take the helmet off. On the 4th of July, the pole was Uncle Sam. On Veterans Day, a soldier. On Halloween, a ghost. The pole was Dad's only concession to glee. We were allowed a single Crayola from the box at a time. One Christmas Eve, he shrieked at Kimmy for wasting an apple slice. He hovered over us as we poured ketchup, saying, "Good enough, good enough, good enough." Birthday parties consisted of cupcakes, no ice cream. The first time I brought a date over, she said, "What's with your dad in that pole?" And I sat there blinking. We left home, married, had children of our own, found the seeds of meanness blooming also within us. Dad began dressing the pole with more complexity and less discernible logic. He draped some kind of fur over it on Groundhog Day and lugged out a floodlight to ensure a shadow. When an earthquake struck Chile, he laid the pole on its side and spray painted a rift in the earth. Mom died and he dressed the pole as death and hung from the crossbar photos of mom as a baby. We'd stop by and find odd talismans from his youth arranged around the base, army medals, theater tickets, old sweatshirts, tubes of mom's makeup. One autumn, he painted the pole bright yellow. He covered it with cotton swabs that winter for warmth and provided offspring by hammering in six cross sticks around the yard. He ran lengths of string between the pole and the sticks and taped to the string letters of apology, admissions of error, pleas for understanding, all written in a frantic hand on index cards. He painted a sign saying love and hung it from the pole, and another that said forgive. And then he died in the hall with the radio on, and we sold the house to a young couple who yanked out the pole and the sticks and left them by the road on garbage day.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'd like to read the beginning for anyone can do it. Her immediate concern was money. It was a Friday when the men didn't come home from the fields. And true, sometimes the men wouldn't return until late. The headlights of the neighborhood work truck turning the corner, the men drunk and laughing from the bed of the pickup. And true, other women might have thought first about the green immigration vans prowling the fields and the orchards all around the valley, ready to take away the men they might not see again for days if good luck held, or even longer if they found no luck at all. When the street fell silent at dusk, the screen doors of the dark houses opened one by one, and the shadows of the women came to sit out on the concrete steps. Delfina was one of them, but her worry was a different sort. She didn't know these women, and these women didn't know her. She and her husband and her little boy had been in the neighborhood for only a month, renting a two-room house at the end of the street with a narrow screened-in back porch, a tight bathroom with no insulation, and a mildewed kitchen. There was only a dirt yard for the boy to play in, and they had to drive into the town center to use the payphone to call back to Texas, where Delfina was from. They had been here just long enough for Delfina's husband to be welcomed along to the field work. The pay split among all the neighborhood men, the work truck chugging away from the street before the sun even rose. When Delfina saw the first shadow rise in defeat, she thought of the private turmoil these other women felt in the absence of their men, and she knew that her own house held none of that. Just days before the end of June, with the rent due soon, she thought that all the women on the front steps might believe that nothing could be any different until the men returned, that nothing could change until they arrived back from wherever they had been taken. She was alert to her worry, to be sure, but she sensed a resolve all her own that was absent in the women putting out last cigarettes and retreating behind the screen doors. She watched as the street went dark past sundown and the neighborhood children were all sent inside to bed. The longer she held her place on her front steps, the stronger she felt. From the far end of the street, one of the women emerged from the porch, and Delfina saw her moving along toward her house, guided by a few dim porch lights and the wan blur of television sets glowing through the windows. When the woman, tall and slender, arrived at her front yard, Delfina could make out the long sleeves of her husband's work shirt and wisps of hair falling from her neighbor's bun. "Buenas tardes," the woman said. "Buenas tardes," Delfina answered, and rather than invite her forward, she rose from the steps and met her at the edge of the yard. "Sometimes they don't come back right away," the neighbor woman said in Spanish. "But don't worry, They'll be back soon, all of them. If they take them together, they come back together.
Thank you for that reading, Manuel, and thank you, George. I want to also welcome Sandra Cisneros, who I think is trapped inside a George Saunders story, being that she's inside a house looking outside at her former house. And thank you, everyone, for coming to tonight's celebration of the short story. And these particular three writers who are some of my favorite short story writers alive, one tenth of them, all in one place, all in one screen. And I guess I want to start out by talking not just about the short story, but about the very short story, being that Sandra Salvador, late or early, is about this long. This is the original edition. And in a funny way, it also has sticks in it. It has crayons like George's story. I think if I had read short stories like this growing up, I would have been an even bigger short story fan. I guess I want to ask you, you know, when did you start writing short stories that were this short? And how did you know that they were stories rather than poems?
Is that a question to me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, I never know what I'm writing, and I don't will the piece of writing to be anything but what it wants to be. So sometimes I write things on an envelope, so it looks like a poem, but I can tell what it wants to be once I read it out loud. And I never intend to write something in short forms. Even House on Manga Street, I meant the chapters to go on, but they stop. And maybe because I'm trained as a poet, I know that last line. And then I just say, okay, I give up. And so this story, Salvador Later Early, was really based on a little boy. You know, I was constantly sat behind him, and the teacher would always call on me, and I never knew where we were because I was always looking at the back of his shirt, which was very dirty. You could tell he'd worn it more than one day, and it looked like he slept in it. And I felt really bad. And I thought, who's your mom? Why doesn't she take care of this? And I would just think about him and wonder where he lived. And that kind of reverie came up when I was thinking about him as an adult, and I knew where he lived. I knew how he got up. I knew he had to feed the little brothers. I knew there was a lot going on in that house. And why did I know it? Because Salvador was me. Salvador was my cousins. It was people I knew. I didn't know it at the time, but when I finished writing it, I realized, oh, this is a little story. It wants to be a little story. And it told me by itself. And I don't think of it as a poem unless it sings. And, you know, stories do sing, but they have a different tune.
Mm. Has two beautiful lines. Salvador with eyes the color of caterpillars. A caterpillar. And then later, further down, inside that 40-pound body of boy with its geography of scars. And I wonder if in the really, really short story, images and colors end up doing the kinds of things that that plot typically does in a longer story. I just love those things. They spin inside me forever, those images.
Well, I'm not very plot driven, my editors have told me, but I just knew that little boy, you know, he wouldn't go away. And I said, what is it about him? So I always write to find out the question. When I finish the story, I know the answer, but I don't know the question until I've written it down on papers. It's kind of a breech baby. And I'm walking towards an answer, but I don't know the question until I finish the story. And what I found out from writing that little story is I was really writing about myself. I was always that little girl with the patched skirt. Maybe my shirt wasn't wrinkled and as dirty as his. Okay. But I still knew, like, I was related to his kind.
Mm. What about you, George? How did this story come about? And had you ever written one as short as it before? Because, you know, from the collections I have of yours, I don't see anything remotely this tight.
Yeah, that's the only one. I was I think I had just finished a more complicated story, and I was working at an engineering company at the time, and I just felt like I had to write faster. So I gave myself the challenge of writing two stories in one day at my desk. And I wrote that one and another one that hasn't survived. And it was just, you know, we had been, our kids were little and we didn't have much money, and we were going to this one church. And every time we went there, we'd pass this house, and a guy had put out, like in the story, these two metal poles like this. And this was up near Rochester. So we had a Buffalo Bills jersey over it. And at the time we were so scattered, you know, so disorganized. I just really admired the guy's bandwidth, you know, that he could have his act together enough to put it, you know, to decorate his yard. I thought, oh God, he's got it over me. So that day in my office, I thought, I'm just going to write about that. And my first impulse was to kind of praise him as I felt. But then, you know, there's just sometimes you're about to start something and a little voice goes, this is going to be a drag, you know? And I think when you hear that voice, it's best to not do it. So I kind of reversed the polarity and focused on, I sort of made him me, like Sandra was saying. I said, well, you know, why would I put up a pole like that? And how would I behave? And I had started with our kids just to notice a little crankiness, a little frugality on my part that I hadn't seen when I was a swinging beatnik, you know? So it was just really a quick burst. And I think I probably rewrote that less than I've ever rewritten anything, you know? And then I published it in the magazine, and it just sat for a long time. And then I put it out in book form in 10th of December. So, but thanks for including it. It's an honor.
I love it. I think a lot of us grew up with hovering parents who are, adjudicating the amount of ketchup that we put on our hot dogs.
Well, that stuff, it's not cheap, you know. Ketchup is not cheap.
In your new book, you have this wonderful series of analyses of these Russian stories. And one of the brief classifications you describe is the pattern story, where a story develops a pattern, and then the pattern changes, and the reader is rewarded by observing the alteration in the pattern. And in the first paragraph of this story, it's all the kids as children. And then the second half of the story, time really speeds up. And I wonder, you know, looking back on the story, if you see this as a pattern story, if there's some other reason why you think this story survived.
Yeah, well, one of the things I say in the book after I said that about pattern stories is that actually every story is a pattern story, because as soon as you say anything, the reader's mind intuits a certain shape to it and then expects something similar. So what I noticed in that, when I just reread the story, is that I was sometimes there's, you know, you're writing along and I can sort of feel what the next expected beat is, and then you don't want to do that exactly. So I could feel in that story, the speeding up of time had to do with starting to feel predictable to myself. So I think that's one of the moves, is to say that, you know, the reader is just as smart as me. And if I can see what's coming, she can too. So I better go the other way real quick. And in a strange way, I think it produces deeper meaning. You know, it produces the meaning of the original plus something else. And as Sandra was saying, the beautiful thing is when you get to the end and you realize you blurted out something that you didn't know you knew. And I think that might have something to do with this, you know, in other words, perceiving the pattern you're enacting and then doing the reader the courtesy of varying it in some way. But then that sort of escalates the whole process.
Manuel, I wanted to ask you if you've ever written stories in this hyper compressed mode. You're one of the strengths of your stories is these beautiful, complex portraits of people, and you basically gave us that with the opening of your story. Have you ever done something like what Sandra and George did in their two short stories, where you simply layered one very fine, neat, short portrait and made that the whole story?
I did. Zigzagger has several of them, and I give thanks to Sandra because of that. Sandra was one of my early inspirations. Seeking to imitate, to emulate some things like My Name from House on Mango Street gave me lots of room to think about how much I too could think about my world and compress it in a short space like that. So two that I remember really enjoying from Zigzagger in terms of writing them is one called Astia, and another one called Swallow. But what I loved about it was that it also gave me room to think about how I could use Spanish. I felt a lot freer in those forms. And it's sort of like learning to roller skate. It's super fun. And then once you start to think about it, it becomes really scary to do it all over again. I haven't done it since the first book because I just get completely frozen by the idea of trying to do something like Styx. I just couldn't do it now. Whereas early on, it was being guided by intuition, being guided by feeling that enough was in that space. And then saying, okay, maybe if I go longer, people won't notice so many things.
Yeah, I have to say Swallow was my second choice, in terms of what to put in. And I and Sandra, your case, Mexican movies was my second. And George, in your case, it was Sea Oak, which is a much longer story. But back to you, Manuel, you talked about a little bit about influence, and you have a new collection coming called The Consequences, and so you're primarily a short story writer, and I wonder if there as you moved into the longer form, if there were other short story writers that sort of reached out and grabbed you and sort of helped you along as you built these sort of longer structures.
Well, I think as I got older, I started to learn how to recognize a really great short story writer, like Edward P. Jones. He's really one of my favorites. But I think back to high school, and I think to the things that I got inspired by, and there are two stories in particular. One of them is John Steinbeck's The Chrysanthemums, and it's easy for me to think about because the fog of the Salinas Valley is the fog of the Central Valley where I grew up in California. And it also, the main character is named after my sister and my grandmother. It's the same name. It's just the shock of recognition, the thing that drew me to the page. And then the other one is Paul's case. Well, I remember reading that one when I was in sophomore year in high school, and sort of sitting there knowing what it was really about, but realizing that not everybody in the classroom was willing to talk about what this kid was up to. And I too was also in the closet at the time. So it was a moment of thinking, hey, a story could really reveal a whole lot and also keep you as a reader, in your own secret. Those are kind of wonderful experiences for me when I think about them. But later in my own reading, I really started gravitating towards, writers who really took a very long, big scoped view of geography and space and place.
Sandra, how about you? I mean, George, you has a line in his book where he's talking about, Plemek and the writing don't usually, and fiction writing don't really live well together. But I do think you can still have stories which are liberationist in their power without them being polemical. As in they can show you something about the heart and about being that sets you free by reading them. And I guess I wanted to know if you ever had a reading experience like that growing up in Chicago or somewhere where you read a story and suddenly felt, seen or somehow freed from something that was holding you back.
Okay, I'm probably going to think of something later and say, oh, I should have said that. But right now, I think the writer that Manuel has mentioned in his own writing that was very influential was the poet, Gwendolyn Brooks, Chicago poet writing about, Bronzeville. And her writing for someone like me coming from another shade of brown in Chicago was astonishing, to read about her poems, but also in her novel, Maud Martha. I especially love Manuel's essay about Maud Martha and how deeply it affected him, so much so that he couldn't speak in class about why. And it's precisely, I think, that book when you recognize that there's something that we haven't mentioned in school, and it's our economic class. We may talk about other issues, but we don't talk about our economic class. And that book, Maud Martha, so beautiful, written in tiny little vignettes, so powerful, is still a favorite of mine, still one that makes me feel like going to my pen.
Well, all of you write about work in your short stories. And it's one of the reasons, among many, that I love. You know, obviously, the music of your writing is a big part of it. But I also just feel like the dignity, and to some degree, the lack of dignity of work in America is reflected in your short stories. And I know, you know, George, in your new book, you have a line that, you know, short story is not a documentary or rigorous accounting of the passage of time or a fair-minded attempt to show life as it is really lived. And yet reading your short stories and reading Sandra's and reading Manuel's, I do feel this reflection of what it feels like to work in America. And I wonder if first, Sandra, if you could talk about this, about how to write work into something as delicate as the short story, because it is so unforgiving of, you know, any kind of broad strokes.
You give me too much credit, John. You think I think about these things, and you know, I don't. When I write, I don't, I shut this off, and I'm just writing from some very intuitive place in my heart, with people who break my heart, people who stay in my heart, whether it's because they had to sleep in their little white shirts and nobody launders them. You know, it really, especially years later when I think about people's lives who I can't forget, that's usually where I go. But I don't think about thinking. I just write. And then I think when I edit. So it's backwards. Mm-hmm.
How about you, George? You've talked in the past about sort of how important it is to have done work outside of writing before entering writing. When you've talked to students, you were a geologist for a petroleum company, among other things. And I know you probably do some intuitive writing as well, but did what I say about work jive with you, or do you feel like it's also just something that emerges because people have to work?
Oh yeah. That. One thing I had for many years, I was a big Hemingway fan, and I tried to write the way, you know, I thought one should, that which for me meant writing about places I hadn't been and living a way that I wasn't living. And so the prose was kind of dead on the page, because I think the reader could feel that I was faking. But when it came alive for me, it was when I started to write about things that were actually mattering, which at that point was money, basically, you know, money and the lack of, and the kind of little failures of grace that I was enacting because I didn't have enough of it. And when I finally allowed that in, you know, to the atmosphere, the prose got funnier and it got tenser, and the problems were smaller problems than I'd been writing about before, but the reader felt them more acutely. So, you know, like, I mean, like for a person, and if a person as a character has been set up the right way, a credit card not going through can be like a cataclysm, you know? So I think what I had done before was I thought, well, the only big literary problems are the ones I've seen before, though I haven't lived them. But the ones that I was living were kind of under my radar. So somehow for me, it was a matter of responding to the prose quality and particularly trying to get more humor in. And when I allowed myself to try to be funny, then my real life flooded in. And suddenly the stories were smaller and more about class, for sure. And about the, as Terry Eagleton says, you know, capitalism plundering the sensuality of the body. So I think there's a correlation between, you know, there's this, if a young writer is trying to imitate another writer, which we always do, there's a failure of intersection between that set and the set of all the things that writer has learned in her life that are hard. And when you get those two things to meld, and suddenly the voice is reflecting your actual, you know, pain or embarrassment or humor, then the prose comes alive. And I think the reader feels valued by that. The reader feels like, oh, you know, he's let me into his game a little bit, as opposed to keeping separate from me and lecturing down on me. So that was my experience anyway.
Mm. Manuel, you mentioned John Steinbeck, and I think it's except for that short story, you know, most of us think of Steinbeck as a novelist and an occasional driver around America with a dog. You know, the short story as a mode, I think, is it doesn't necessarily have the rep. It doesn't have the romance rep, which, thank God, it doesn't, because otherwise people would be delivering short stories to each other as part of floral bouquets.
That's a great idea.
but I think, you know, the short story has it tells us a lot of news, and I'm definitely reading that in the collection, The Consequences. The stories that make up that feels very much in the Steinbeckian bailiwick, and it's a lot of characters living in America, working in sort of migrant farm jobs. And I wonder if you can talk about building that collection as a short story collection rather than a novel, and what that allows you to do, you know, as a fiction writer.
Well, you know, as I've gotten older, I've gotten much, much better at really listening to my parents and the stories that they've been telling me. I've heard these stories many, 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 many times, but just something broke in terms of hearing them, but then also hearing their echo, what they were really trying to tell me. I mean, they were stories of survival, you know, so when I think about my upbringing and, you know, the work that I worked in the fields up until sixth grade, I got off easy in terms of my siblings. I'm the baby, you know, so when I think about those experiences, and I've tried to distill some of those experiences, I think the first direction I would go was lamentation, you know, oh, poor me. And it took me some maturity and some growing up to realize, wow, there are parents here trying to feed their kids. And what does that mean? And really going back and thinking about all of those nuances that my parents were really feeding me. But I think it also speaks, I think, to I've been reading your book, by the way. This is I love to look for so many different ways of trying to figure out how a story operates, because I do believe, yes, some of it is intuition, but I think you phrase it as intuition plus reiteration. I forget what the phrase was in one of the ones that I really, yes, really liked, but there was another phrase in there that I thought really it hit me in the heart, which is you really want a reader to sense that you respect them. And that's, I'm putting that together with my parents and the stories that they've told me. And so I'm telling you this so that you can hear, you know, hear what I can't put into a story in another way. And it really opened up a whole lot for me in terms of getting some accuracy towards the things that they experienced in the 70s and 80s, for sure.
That's beautiful.
George, do you have any stories that you have been told or that you heard that are still sort of turning inside of you? You don't have to enumerate them, but I'm curious if you have that same, you know, titration process inside of you that Manuel just described, of things being told to you and that you needing time in many ways to figure out how to shape them.
No, it's so funny. That was so beautiful. That, Manuel, I noticed, I just was writing about Dubliners, trying to write an introduction for Dubliners. And I was sort of just, you know, telling anecdotes from my childhood. And as I did it, I thought, oh my God, that's really interesting. I never thought of that as story material. So I think what Manuel says is true, that the maturity is, I think, to go, as he said, from lamentation, and here I paraphrase, to celebration, you know, to say, well, these things that maybe when you're 20, you'd use it to make a kind of one tone symphony about how hard things are. Mm-hmm. But then you get a little older and you go, oh, that's kind of beautiful. And there's a sacrifice in there. And there's, so I think for me, that's my whole goal, is to try to, you know, retain my sense of satire about things. Because I think in this time, in this country, that's healthy, but also to remember that there's an undertone to everything of sacrifice and heroism and celebration. And that's a very hard thing, you know, I found that to celebrate the positive tonalities in life is actually harder than anything else. It's easy to go over into sentimentality. It's easy to go over into hyperbole, but to precisely praise, you know, a positive trait, like in Manuel's story, I won't give it away, but that depiction of the mother is so multifaceted and beautiful, and you love her because she's trying. You know, she's trying hard and taking chances. So I think that's really, for me, that's the only thing that's interesting now, is to try to learn to praise the world as well as blame it, you know.
Mm. That's sort of what makes Salvador later early so heartbreaking, is you sense that this boy, this 40-pound boy, is holding a whole family together. Yeah. And Sandra, in that book, Woman Hollering Creek, the first story is my Lucy friend who smells like corn. And it starts out with, you know, Lucy, the Texas girl who smells like corn, like Frito Bandito chips. And I feel like those early stories, there's a lot of stories that are looking at people who are carrying a lot. And it feels like part of the acuteness of the observation is a form of praise, you know, of acknowledgement. And I wonder if that was part of what you were, you know, stepping back from them now, not obviously designed that way, but stepping back, do you feel like that was part of what you were doing?
You know, I'm haunted by people I meet, and some of them, you know, just came into my life very briefly. And Lucy, I had written about her in House on Motley Street as Lucy. And when she came back, it was when I was living in Texas. And I finally realized, I get it now. I live in Texas. I know why she talked funny. I know why she smelled like corn. You know, all the parts come together when you change geography. And, you know, I realized, oh, she is a migrant. That's how she wound up in Chicago with no furniture. Yes. So I hadn't said everything about her, but writing that story made me figure all these things out. And, you know, I just, like I said, sometimes I dash it on an envelope. I don't know if it's going to be a poem or what it wants to be. And when I was writing that book, Woman Hollering Creek, it was the first time that my stories were going to be bought by a major New York publishing house. Big, scary for me, you know, big. And I, you know, it kind of blocked me, because as soon as you start thinking about the reader, you cannot write. The whole trick for me writing and to uncensor myself is to think what I have to say is like too dangerous to publish. So when that story began, I just, you know, I don't think it's going to be a story. I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe it's just a postcard. Maybe it's a journal note. Maybe I'll throw it in the trash. I don't know. But I'm thinking, why is this girl haunting me? And, you know, the smells are so ancestral. And I remember loving her so much when I was a child that I would leave my hair unwashed for 5 days so it could smell like hers. You know, if I could just smell like her, that was just the highest admiration. And I realized that, you know, my friends that had the least amount of material goods, they didn't have the Barbie dolls like other girls. They had supermarket bags that they drew dolls and drew their clothes. And we would spend hours, you know, playing like that. But they had this richness of imagination. And I wanted to write from that point of view of someone who doesn't have a lot of little sisters, doesn't have a lot of family members, and who looks at someone like this who has nothing and thinks like, that's the greatest thing in the world. And I remember feeling that kind of admiration for her. I have no sisters, and the admiration I had for her and her family. So that it took me there. I didn't know that's what I was going to say. If I thought it, I probably wouldn't be able to write it. I just followed the smell of her skin and her hair.
Some of the questions are coming through from the audience, and I'd love to pass some of them along. And right now, one that builds off what you just said, Sandra, has to do with honing of craft and trusting your storytelling abilities. I wonder, any of you, was there a moment when your education kind of left off and your own trust in yourself took over? And you know, this isn't 8 Mile. I know it doesn't happen on one day when you walk up to the stage and start freestyle rapping. You know, I know this happens over time, but was there a moment where you suddenly thought, okay, I need to trust myself? And if you can recall it, what was it?
I'll try that one. That was right after I finished the MFA. Once I knew I was no longer going to be looked at by anybody, I sat in a bagel shop in Ithaca, New York, and I wrote in a notebook and I started a story called Campo, because I knew no one was going to look at it. It was just me. And it turned out to be the first story I ever published. So maybe that says something about MFA programs, I don't know. But I think it also has to do with, again, youth starting out, learning how to build community with other writers, learning how to trust your own instincts as you're trying to hone them. It's for all the students who are listening, it's a really wonderful time. But that step when you really just, jump off the cliff, you have to trust that you're going to fly. That's for sure. And I think that moment when I was very sure that no eyes were looking at me, I felt a lot braver.
Sandra, George, do you want to chip in here?
George wants to say.
There was just one moment where I had been writing I'd written a 700-page novel that didn't work. And I tell the story in the book and I was just despondent. And I was like, all right, well, I guess this is for me. And then I was at work and I just happened to write some poems, kind of like Dr. Seuss imitations. Wasn't even writing. It was just farting around during our conference call. And I brought them home and my wife read them and she really responded. They were funny and they were kind of weird. And it was the first positive response I'd had to my work in about 7 years. Usually people would just be like, oh yeah, I read it, or you certainly seem to be spending some time with those things, she was laughing. And so something clicked in me where it was just like, okay, so entertainment is not only allowed, but it's for you, it's the only way. I have to think about making someone laugh or making someone happy. And as soon as I gave myself permission to do that, then I got confident, even literally the next, I was like, oh, I know how to, at least I've been doing that my whole life in some form or another. So, but that was after, 5 or 6 years of worshiping at the altar of sort of conventional writing advice, and trying to do what somebody far away was telling me to do instead of just relying on my instincts as a person.
For me, it was, the what they always tell you, you can find your voice. But how do you know what your voice is when you're 21 years old or when you don't talk, or you're afraid to speak? So what's your voice? You don't have a voice. And for me, it took getting angry in an MFA program and really getting angry. But first I got depressed because I realized my class difference in a summer class and everybody was talking about their houses and I could visualize their house. And I realized I was ashamed about bringing them to the apartments or the houses I had lived in. And that woke me up and made me feel like quitting the MFA program because I didn't feel smart enough, good enough. I didn't feel enough to be in an MFA program. And luckily for me, I'm slow to move. So I was going to quit the program, felt sorry for myself, but then I turned it over. And this is the thing I think Latinas have, we have, the depression, but the other side of the depression is coraje, rage. And I got really mad and I said, how come I've never seen my story in the library or in the movie or in the newspaper written about with love? And I thought, oh, I'm not gonna quit. I'm gonna write that story. And that anger, I realized, is so much a part of my DNA because my mother was such an angry woman. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to write something that no one in this program can tell me I'm wrong. So what am I an expert on? Like crummy apartments, cucarachas, rats, people jumping out in the dark. I know that. And so I thought, that's what I started with, poems about my neighborhood, stories. And suddenly it was just like the tsunami. I just had so much to say. But of course, in class, I was very shy. and I wouldn't say anything. I just would end the minute.
One question here is, this is also for all of you. George, when I was at Granta, we run a lovely little short by you about living in Chicago and working for your family's chicken restaurant, driving the chicken van. Am I making this up? It sounds almost.
No, no, that's it.
And I think there's some material in here that will relate to this question. The person has asked if you were storytellers growing up as children, and I think in that piece you talk about learning to become a kind of wise guy growing up in Chicago. That part of growing up there was always having a retort or having something that could spin back on someone if they came at you. And were you also a storyteller as well as a joker, or did that evolve later?
Well, we by the way, the place was called Chicken Unlimited, and our motto was Chicken Unlimited doesn't stop at chicken. That was my first Zen koan. it was storytelling, but it was often a lot of like memorizing George Carlin and Richard Pryor and performing it. And then the next step up from that was sort of imitating a teacher and sort of narrating an episode from her life and her voice. And then the even higher level was to just invent a persona and riff in that. So I think it was very much literary storytelling. We didn't know that's what it was, but it had the same quality of, it was one way you could get power. I heard a writer one time saying that you become a writer the minute you realize that language is power. And so for us, that was a way of holding the floor in class or attracting attention. So definitely, you know, but again, that was the whole journey I had to reinvent, you know, for all those years, I thought, yeah, that's fine for the neighborhood, but writing should be very high and very impossible to understand, you know, and then to come back around and go, no, those were short stories. They really were short stories in voice. They were like, you know, totally legitimate.
Manuel, how about you? Did you have a period of sort of mimicry growing up, or were you listening to storytellers, or did you become one sort of fib teller, wise guy?
Oh, I was absolutely the listener absorber. I would crawl under the table and, you know, listen to the conversations going on that were none of my business, or going to church with my grandmother. And reading Bible stories underneath the pew. I was always looking for just sort of two things going on at one time, my nose in a book, but then my ear this way. And I took in a lot. I'm actually in my family the person who remembers things that other people swear didn't happen. It's like, no, I am, my mother and I have great moments like that where I just remember conversations, you know, that we've had. And she's like, I never would have told you that. I said, but Mom, you absolutely did. You absolutely did. Yeah. So that's the kind of person I was in my family. Absolutely.
We're running out of time here. And so I just want to circle back to the story as a form and to some of the greats. I can remember some of the stories in here, where I was the moment I read them, you know, and I definitely feel that some of these stories have changed my life, you know, and I wonder, you know, if you have that as well. This is coming from a question from the audience. You know, I think all of us have that book, you know, that you sort of bent back inside out as you read it and sort of tried to climb inside and emerged, you know, another species. Have you had that experience with a story as in something that changed you in a fundamental way?
I would mention just a story called Hot Ice by Stuart Dybeck. I read it in the Chicago Public Library when I was roofing there, and I was just lost. You know, I didn't have any idea what I should be doing. And that was set in Chicago, and it had a lot of Chicagoisms, and it was, handful of friends wandering around outside of prison. And it just felt like, and it was roughly in my dad's neighborhood, and Dybeck and my dad had gone to the same high school. So for me, it was the first time that a story intersected with the world I knew. And I could kind of understand the transform between, okay, this is real life. Here's what he's done to make it a story. He's exaggerated and compressed, and he's playing up the jokes a little. And it really was, it freed me of a kind of an addiction to only liking stories by dead people. Now suddenly it was like, oh yeah, I see, this is my world. And one could make some kind of literature about the actual life that I was living. So that I remember that feeling of reading it my face got really hot because I was like, oh God, how exciting and how stupid are you to have wasted the last 5 years never reading contemporary fiction? And then I was kind of off to the races, still trying to catch up.
I love that story. He also has a beautiful story called Blight, which I love about Chicago, which is more of a novella. Sandro, how mm-hmm. about you? Did you have a kind of epiphanic moment, you know, where you just thought, oh my God, this story has reached inside, changed some internal organs?
Well, I think that happens to me every book that I want to read. You know, there's always something in it. I like rereading books that are my favorites that I go back to, because like the first time you read them just because you're, you know, on this fast car ride and you're enjoying the view. But I like rereading them because I want to go back and look and see how they're constructed and what I can learn from them as a writer, not just as a passenger. You know, so I think right now I'm pulling a lot of books out of the shelf that are just favorites that I come back to and look at. I read a lot of things, and you know, I'm writing poetry right now, so I'm reading a lot of poetry. And I just always go back to what day of the week and like what's happening. But during the pandemic, it seemed like that's when you need like Janis Joplin would say, paraphrasing, that's when you need literature most of all, you know? So I felt like I really needed writers and writing during this time just to keep my spirit up. No? Didn't you feel like that, Manuel, during this time?
Yeah, and to go back to rereading, I mean, a story where I've broken the spine on the book, it's from Joan Silber's Ideas of Heaven, and it's called The High Road. It's a really phenomenal story about a gay man in 1980s New York. And there's just something about that story about longing and desire and hatred and love that I just can't get enough of. I feel really lucky to have been able to have been in an audience, or actually it was a panel and she was in the audience and I got to say that in front of her. But likewise, here's the second time, because back to my name, Sandra, that one was one that I encountered when I was 16 years old on the campus of UC Santa Cruz. Yes, yeah, it was. And it was a writing prompt. And it was one of these moments where I got all of this wonderful praise from a graduate student named Frances. I don't remember what her last name is, but I really wish I could somehow get in touch with her to thank her, because she gave me all these wonderful notes. But that was the ticket where I could see, you know, something like ZZ the X would do, because that's, you know, that had that Z in my name.
You know where that came moment from?
Yes, where did it come from?
That Z the X came from Malcolm X, because, you know, when I read Malcolm X, it was like blew my head off. I thought, what? I'm leaving the MFA program and no one told me about this book. You know, so I was writing House at the same time that I was reading Autobiography of Malcolm X, and I love the idea of naming yourself and mm-hmm. getting rid of your slave name. Really moved me. So that's where that came from.
Yeah. Well, it had an influence all the way down here.
Mira nomás.
Yeah.
Gosh. Oh, thank you so much, all of you, for joining us, Manuel and George and Sandra. And for allowing yourself to be republished in this book, which was such a joy to put together, because during the pandemic, it's what I did, is read and reread short stories. And, you know, I didn't choose in advance, and it was just it was an embarrassment of riches, you know, to be able to just read short stories in the dark, you know, with the
land. I'm honored to be with Manuel and George. It's an honor.
Likewise, for me too.
Well, thank you all of you for joining us. Please check out the work of Sandra Cisneros and Manuel Munoz and George Saunders and the anthology itself. Also, thank you to the library and the Library Foundation for hosting us, and to libraries everywhere for nurturing our spirits and preventing the ruination of the spirit in dark times, as you do. Well, enjoy your night. This is going to be a very swift goodbye. I'll click leave and then I'll go off to dinner or maybe short story nights. Thank you for joining us. It's lovely to see you, Manuel, George, and Sandra. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.